Ain't no sunshine when she's gone, and she's always gone too long. Anytime she goes away, wonder this time where she's gone. Wonder if she's gone to stay.
Welcome back. That's, of course, Al Jarreau, born on this day in 1940. Ain't No Sunshine, one of the greatest singers. I could listen to Al Jarreau all day long, but we have lots to talk about here in the show, so we'll start with that. John Cardin put a bill into the state legislature, House Bill 43, which would criminalize cybersexual harassment that we call revenge porn, and the bill passed the House delegates with a unanimous vote. It's going to the Senate, and we've had conversations about revenge porn before, its effect on women, on our society, on our culture, the pain it gives people, the viciousness of it. But there's a lot of argument over how best to address this, whether it's, it should be addressed legislatively or in other ways. And John Cardin will be with us in just a moment. He is going to join us to talk about the bill he put in and what it means. We're joined now also by Tony Holness, who is Public Policy Associate at the ACLU of Maryland. Tony, good to have you with us.
Good morning, Mark. It's good to be here.
And Anne-Marie Cirani is with us, a professor of English at the Maryland Community College and a victim advocate for Cyber Civil Rights Initiative, or CCRI. And Anne-Marie, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Hi. Good morning. Thank you for having me.
And you can join us here at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. You can log on to our Facebook pages with your thoughts, or you can tweet us at Mark Steiner, 410-319-8888. This is something that many of you have written us about, your concerns about it. We want to hear from you today, your thoughts on what this does to our society and to people individually. And Anne-Marie, talk a bit about this. Let's talk a bit about how this has become such a national phenomenon and what it's really, what hold it's taken on our country.
Okay. This issue has really become a severe problem. In my work with the Cyber Civil Rights Initiative, we receive emails from victims every day. Sometimes we'll have four or five victims emailing us, you know, asking us what to do, how we can help. There have been reports not only in the United States, but from around the world, Canada, Brazil, Australia, of women committing suicide because they can't deal with the pain and with the offline threats and the offline stalking that occurs as a result of having intimate photos posted without consent.
John Cardin, you're joining us. Welcome. Good to have you with us.
Good to be with you, Mark. And Anne-Marie is such a wonderful advocate for this. It's been spectacular working with her.
Well, talk a bit about the bill and why you put it in. And I want to talk about some of the issues that I know that Tony Holness and others have, and the ACLU and others are raising around the First Amendment issues. But let's begin with what this bill does and why you pursued it so intensely.
Well, I began by saying, you know, my vision as I have represented Marylanders has been to say, let's create an environment where people feel protected and safe. And where are the issues? What are the issues of tomorrow that are really going to resonate with people who are feeling vulnerable? And I learned about this issue from some of my friends who have kids who are high schoolers and in college who I didn't realize how pervasive it is until I met somebody like Anne-Marie and Danielle Citron from University of Maryland Law School. And they explained to me how this has become a huge issue around the country of people's lives being destroyed by the click of a mouse, their reputations, their relationships with their family, with their friends, can be destroyed simply by one person doing this terrible, humiliating act without permission of the victim.
So what will this act do? I mean, this is, I mean, when you look at the bill, I was in California, people actually get jail time for this. I mean, what will this bill do? How would it even begin to control this?
So what it does is it prohibits, there are four elements to the law. What it does is it prohibits the intentional posting of an explicit image on the internet. And most of that is, in fact, already defined by law. What is the internet? What's an explicit or pornographic image? What it means to intentionally post, it means obviously that you had the intent, not necessarily of maliciously destroying somebody's life, but the intent of posting it without the other person's permission. It's a very high bar. There has to be, in Maryland, you have to show serious emotional distress, which requires a physical manifestation of that distress in order to prove that somebody has been negatively impacted. It's a pretty high standard, but we thought that would be appropriate. The victim had to have a reasonable expectation that the images were meant to be private and not meant to be published. So, for example, if the Anthony Weiner exception would be one. If Anthony Weiner posts something, it would not be a reasonable expectation given his public nature and public type of presence for him to expect that to remain private. And the penalty provision, it's a misdemeanor. It's punishable by up to 2 years in jail or a fine of up to $5,000 or both. My original bill was a little bit higher. It was a felony because I think that, again, when you're destroying people's lives and you're causing, as Anne-Marie had already said, suicidal tendencies, that this is a serious matter. And what we're trying to do is change people's behavior and realize that there are consequences to these ridiculous and humiliating actions.
So, Tony, let me bring you in now. Tony Holness, I'm glad you joined us. I appreciate you being part of the program.
Thanks for having me.
A lot of what I've been reading about, not sort of the opposition to these bills, but questioning these bills, is not saying that we shouldn't address the issue of revenge porn because it's a horrendous act. It usually affects women, and we could go into the psychology of all that in a moment. But there are some other issues here that I think that the ACLU, you and others are raising about what these bills might do, the unintended consequences of these bills.
That's exactly right, Mark. So the ACLU of Maryland is well aware and, in fact, equally distraught by revenge pornography. Let me pause a minute just to say hi to Anne-Marie and Delegate Cardin. It's good to talk with you all again.
Good to hear from you, too.
Hi, thank you. Hi there. We recognize, you know, the real harms that are caused to victims like Anne-Marie and particularly women. So our purpose in weighing in on this legislation is not to minimize that suffering because we recognize how harmful it is, but our purpose is just to ensure that the legislation, should it pass, include certain key elements so that it remains within constitutional bounds, it avoids criminalizing unintended persons, like you mentioned, and it does not inadvertently suppress the free flow of information that we have, especially on the Internet. And we've worked with Delegate Cardin, and, you know, the bill has come a long way. There's been a lot of hard work by the legislators and the advocates and organizations like the ACLU to get the bill to where it is right now. As it stands, there is some concern that it does criminalize third parties. And what I mean by that, these are persons who have received the image but have had no hand in the taking of the image and maybe don't even have a relationship with the subject of the image. And now courts have held time and again that individuals who have received unlawfully shared information, so long as they did not have any hand in the unlawful acquisition, may not be criminalized for sharing that information. And, you know, by criminalizing third parties and by having criminality follow the image from hand to hand, what the law may do is actually criminalize the image itself, and that's problematic because it necessarily will suppress the free flow of information that that we have and that we so value.
So what do you mean by the free flow of information? How does it affect – I'll come right back to Anne-Marie and John, but what do you mean by, sure, by affecting the free flow of information?
So, for example, you might consider a third party or someone who's received an image – and they don't necessarily know if this is amateur pornography or they were not privy to the taking of the image or the initial disclosure of the image. So that person may not know that they do not have permission to share the image, right? They may be mean-spirited, right? And the example we always use is the class of high school students, right? They may be mean-spirited. They may have some ill intent towards the subject of the image. But, you know, is that really who we're trying to criminalize here? It would seem to me that the most optimal criminalization would attach at the initial disclosure, you know, the proverbial floodgate, so to speak. That, you know, the first person who breached the confidentiality or the reasonable expectation of privacy that the subject has in the image. That's really who we should be targeting.
So, and I'm curious what we know about this, Anne-Marie, excuse me. How much of the revenge porn we see is, in fact, the act of very young people?
Well, it's interesting. The ages actually range. I get quite a few victims who are under 18, and right away I refer them to the FBI because that's child pornography. We are seeing a lot of 20-year-olds, but, I mean, we also have our fair share of 30, 40. I think I had a 50-year-old victim contact me within the past month. The age range is very high. It's not just dumb little teenagers who don't know any better. There really is no target demographic.
I guess what I'm asking is it's not so much dumb little teenagers I'm concerned about. When I was asking that question, I wasn't clear. And maybe you all can jump in on this, but what the question I was asking was, how much of the revenge porn that's out there is the act of young people themselves, mm-hmm. Angry at somebody else in their school, angry at an ex-boyfriend or girlfriend, especially an ex-girlfriend, and put it out there? How much of that comes from that segment of our population? Do we know? And if we do know, should those young people be treated differently than a 50 or 60-year-old man or a 40-year-old person who does this to an ex-girlfriend? Do you see what I'm saying?
Let me just really quickly. The whole thing is, this is whenever there is a posting like this, it is done with malicious intent. This is not something that anybody, even if we take the third-party situation, whenever there's a third party involved, usually it's paired with some sort of derogatory comment. It's well known. It's not an accident, and it's not a mistake. It's not a, oops, I did it again. This is very, very malicious and intentional behavior, and it doesn't matter what the age range is. The perpetrators of this crime are really out to wreck someone's life.
There's no question about that.
Mark,
John?
If I can chime in on that very quickly, just a couple responses. First of all, to your question about young people versus old people, I've had the opportunity, as you know, to travel around the entire state of Maryland as I am seeking higher office. But
we heard rumors you were running for Attorney General, yes.
I'm running for Attorney General. It's not just a rumor, I'm officially in. But the fact of the matter is that what I have learned as I've gone around is that the nods I get from older people, mostly because of their kids or their grandkids who have been involved in
right.
activities that have led them to be harassed or victimized by this. And it is pervasive across the board, but you are correct that young people are the ones who just have a different definition of privacy and a different understanding of what is acceptable and what is not acceptable than maybe my generation or your generation. My goal is to help get us to realize there are consequences to our actions and for people to be careful about what they are doing without consent of another person. And to then relate back to the question or that to the comments that were posed by our good friend from the ACLU, who I really do appreciate working together with, and I think that that we did come a long way, at least with the original drafting of my bill. This bill did have some amendments on it, but you'll note that line 31, section C, subsection 1 of the bill, the language says they have to know that the other person did not consent to the placement of the image on the internet in order to be convicted of this crime. So, if a third party can prove that they had no knowledge of the lack of consent, then they can't be convicted of this. Now, that goes back to Anne-Marie's comment. Fact is that if you are a third party who is putting out something that has hateful language on it, you should probably do your due diligence before you publish this, knowing that you may that a jury may decide that you should have known, you knew, or you should have known that this was obviously revenge porn. It doesn't have to just be revenge; it can be what I call cybersexual harassment. If you have the image of somebody else and you put it out with the purpose to harm or damage somebody's reputation or somebody's ability to function, you don't even have to have the intention for ill will. You just have to have the intention to put it out there without their consent. You could face significant penalties because this is actually hurting people's lives. It is really damaging people's lives. This is the next generation of assault. And it's in cyber world, and we have to be very careful about that.
So I'm, there's something I really want to question about that, but it's something I was remiss in not doing at the very beginning, because I want to come, and I need to go back to that. Anne-Marie, one of the things we did not do was really introduce you to our public, because many people don't know your story and who you are. And I, so I wish you'd help us, I mean, tell us a bit about what happened to you.
Okay. In 2010, I was in a long-distance relationship with a man who I had dated in high school back in 1985. We were engaged to get married in 1990, but went our separate ways. I decided to go to college. We reunited and rekindled the relationship. And I noticed during the course of our relationship when we got back together that he was growing increasingly manipulative and controlling. So I ended the relationship, and during the course of this, I did allow him to take some nude images of me, and he threatened after the fight that he was going to create an auction on eBay and auction off the CD with those images on it. And then, so he did, and he sent images to friends and family. He emailed friends and family with links to the auction, and it was just an absolute, absolute nightmare. Mm. Then again, I blocked all contact with him. I hadn't heard from him. No emails, no phone calls, nothing. 14 months later, I received an anonymous email that a profile had been created of me on a porn website that featured nude images of me. But it also had my full name, the town where I live, the college and campus where I teach, which, you know, not only was I, you know, being victimized on this website, I was then a target for offline stalking, and the danger became not cyber danger, but physical danger. And that's when I got frustrated with Maryland law, and I said, this is it, I'm changing the law. This can't happen to anyone anymore.
Well, I'm glad you shared that. I apologize for not doing that at the very top of our conversation. Tony, I know you have to leave in about 4 or 5 minutes, so I really want you to kind of jump in
sure.
here on this whole question, because I mean, you know, if this happened to any one of us, our children, our wives, our girlfriends, our daughters, we'd be outraged and want something to be done about it.
Right.
Right?
You know, Mark, the problem with criminalizing third parties, even ill-intentioned third parties, is that we may criminalize individuals that we don't actually intend to burden with a criminal record. And, you know, I could really give you a host of examples. You mentioned our children. You know, consider, for example, two siblings. A brother gets wind of a suggestive photo of his sister that's going around. You know, he intends to get his sister in trouble, but intends to cause her harm, tells mom and dad, you know, if she actually does suffer some actual, you know, disciplinary measures, whatever that may be. But are we going to criminalize that sibling for having reported his sister's, you know, suggested photo on the internet? This is a third party. This is who may be swept up by this law. And so, you know, I really think we have to be careful about attaching criminality to the image, you know, because once we've criminalized an image, then, you know, we've really called into question what information individuals can share on the internet without really giving them any advance notice of what information of what conduct might be criminal.
Tony, great example. Let me just suggest, as a criminal defense attorney in my own right, I've had many situations where I've had spouses who have filed charges against each other. I've had siblings file charges against each other, and the discretion in working with state's attorneys, assistant state's attorneys, to determine what's the best way to approach this, and oftentimes you can get a dialogue going and work things out in advance of any kind of action by a judge. That's
right.
The discretion is still within the court and within the state's attorney's office to determine what is the best situation. But there are plenty of malicious people out there, regardless of whether they're related to somebody or not, who are out simply to destroy people's lives. And you know what? I don't care whether they're a brother or sister. If they're out there trying to destroy somebody's life by exposing something that they didn't have any permission to do in the first place, then they're not an innocent third party. And I mean, and so I applaud you in your efforts to say, let's not go after the wrong people. But we have to give some discretion to our law enforcement folks to know when it's appropriate to go after them and when it's not.
Tony?
The Supreme Court has held unambiguously that a law that is subject only to prosecutorial discretion is necessarily unconstitutional. Listen, the purpose of our criminal laws is to put the public on notice as to what conduct is criminal. If the enforcement of that law is subject only to a prosecutor's discretion, the public has no notice.
Right, but that's not what we're talking about here, first of all. And if a state's attorney decides to suggest to a judge that this is appropriate for a probation before judgment because we don't want this person to have a criminal record, then a judge will take that advice under consideration. But the fact is that he ought to learn that he's got to be careful about what he's doing before he starts trying to destroy his sister's life.
So we have to take a break here. Tony, you have to leave, don't you?
I do have to run. I'm sorry.
That's too bad. I'm going to get you back into this because we're getting to the core of it now. But I'll try to hold up your end here with some questions. Tony Holness, thanks for joining us from the ACLU of Maryland.
Thanks, Tony.
Thank you so much. Take care.
We'll be right back with Delegate John Cardin and Anne-Marie Chiarini. Did I say your last name right, Anne-Marie?
Yes, you did. Thank
Chiarini,
you.
Good. I'll be right back. Stay with us. We'll continue our look at revenge porn. James Taylor, of course, born on this day in 1948, and we went to break with the great Charlie Parker, Bird Feathers, who passed away on this day in 1955, one of our great composers in America. We are here with Delegate John Cardin, who represents the 11th District in the Maryland House of Delegates, sponsor of House Bill 43, which criminalizes cyber sexual harassment, known as revenge porn. The bill passed the House of Delegates with a unanimous vote. Of course, Delegate Cardin is also a candidate for Attorney General. We're joined here also by Anne-Marie Chiarini, who is a professor of English at Maryland Community College, a victim of advocate for Cyber Civil Rights Initiative. She was a victim of this herself. 410-319-8888 is our number here. You can write to us at steinershow@gmail.com. Log on to our Facebook pages. Tweet me at Mark Steiner. 410-319-8888. Well, Tony had to leave, but let me just push a little bit further what she was saying. I mean, is there a, people have been writing about this across the country where bills were passed in other states. And like pushed in California, and many things start in California, move east. But part of the issue was, is that is criminalizing this behavior for children, for teenagers, really the answer to the problem? That we want to kind of fill our already overcrowded criminal justice system with people who have taken part in this horrendous, disgusting act. Are there other ways for us to deal with other than putting people in prison? John?
So the answer is, first of all, prison is not necessarily what is going to be divvied out to a defendant in this case. We can talk about Grace's Law that was passed last year, which criminalizes cyberbullying. And the fact is that the state's attorney's office came and testified about all the different tools in the tool chest, particularly for minors. Everything from, counseling to probation to certainly to incarceration or to fines. And so there are a whole plethora of different options out there. And the fact is that we are in the next generation of issues, pressures, and activities that particularly young people are getting into, which is putting them in precarious situations, both from a victim standpoint and from a perpetrator standpoint. And we need to make sure that people understand that this is serious business. When you, at the click of a mouse, and I've said this before, you can destroy somebody's life. And once those images are out there, by the way, and Anne-Marie Chiarini will tell you this, it is nearly impossible to get them taken down. So your life is exposed on the internet forever. And sometimes it can cost thousands, if not tens of thousands of dollars, to remove an image from a site. Some of these sites are put up just so they can extort money from people. And so you've got these revenge porn aficionados who are then making money on this by charging people to take the pictures down. And just taking it down off of one site doesn't mean it hasn't been captured. and put elsewhere. So these are there are huge consequences to these actions. And when you talk about whether we should criminalize or not, of course, we don't want to put people in jail. We want to change their behavior. And so that is what this is doing. I worked with Professor Danielle Citron from University of Maryland School of Law in the drafting of this legislation because, you know, as an expert on cybersecurity, cyber communications, and online privacy, a national expert on this right here at University of Maryland. And our goal, again, is not to throw people in jail. It's to get people to realize that the consequences of their actions are very serious, and they need to think about it before they start clicking that mouse.
So, and I'm talking about, Emery, what your views are about the consequences of this and what we should do. I mean, we are talking about a lot of very young people here. You know, we're talking about people who are 16, 17, 18 years old, both the victims and the perpetrators.
Well, for the perpetrators, regardless of how young they are, and what John said is a very salient point that we need to take into consideration. We are looking at a cultural phenomenon. We're looking at a set of behaviors. It is in this digital age, and I really don't, I hate that phrase, but unfortunately there's no better way to describe it. Young folks, and I hate saying that too, because it makes me sound old, they are very accustomed to this instant sharing of their lives, this oversharing. And so on the one hand, we need to send the message. This is about changing attitudes and changing behaviors. I completely agree with Delegate Cardin on that. That if we say, hey, this is illegal, the incidence of this behavior will decrease. If we go back in time to, you know, good old-fashioned stalking and harassment offline, once those laws went into place and they were fought tooth and nail when people were presenting harassment and stalking legislation, once those went into place, the numbers of the incidents of harassment and stalking decreased. It didn't end, but it certainly decreased. Young people need to learn that there's consequences, that this behavior is absolutely unacceptable because victims are the ones being punished. Victims are the ones losing jobs. Victims are the ones being kicked out of school. Victims are the ones who are suffering the emotional distress and still being told that they did something wrong, while the perpetrators walk around scot-free, getting away with it, destroying lives, and laughing at our expenses. So not having legislation, not having something in place to say, look, don't do this, is basically allowing this behavior to occur and, you know, blaming the victim and putting the victim in the position where she, and I say she because 87% of victims are women, has to, you know, like John said, have her life destroyed, and lives are truly destroyed.
Let me open the phones here, 410-319-8888. Folks, your thoughts on this? A very serious subject. I'm glad we're tackling it here on the Steiner Show, here with Delegate John Cardin and Marie Chiarini, 410-319-8888. Danielle, you're on the air. Dan, you're on the air.
Oh, I am sorry, Mark. I was calling to say that any law that is based on a victim giving consent by the nature of her actually laying down and agreeing to take photographs of herself, she, by her action, consent to those photographs being used. I just don't think Anne-Marie is the right person to champion such a law.
Well, I mean, there's a difference between people taking photographs of somebody and then somebody illicitly using those photographs without permission. People do all kinds of things in the privacy of their own home, but that is something different than somebody using that and spreading it out across the land. They're two different things.
Well, I don't necessarily agree with that. I think that when you do something such as Anne-Marie, I think that you, by your very action, give consent to use those things in any way that a person chooses.
All right, well, let me let Anne-Marie respond. Anne, go ahead. Anne-Marie, I'm sorry.
I did not choose to have my sexuality broadcast. Someone made that decision for me. It was made extremely clear within this relationship, or that relationship, excuse me, that those images were to remain confidential. It is absolutely ludicrous to say, well,
you did this, you got what you deserved, that's victim blaming. It's the easy way out, and it lets the perpetrators off the hook. Again, you're encouraging criminal behavior. Look at the behavior, not at the victim. Look at the behavior of the perpetrator. The goal was to intentionally seek revenge. Revenge is meant to hurt someone. I didn't do anything to hurt anyone. I was engaging in normal activity within a loving, committed, monogamous relationship. He was the one who decided to behave maliciously.
Let me move on to the phones here, because I think that you raised an important point, Emory, that had to be heard. I wanted to get that out there, because I think that, you know, people do all kinds of things sexually towards one another inside their own relationships that are private. Those are not things for the public to see or know. And consent between adults, between two people who love each other, is consent, not consent to abuse that outside in public. So, John, go ahead, John. I'm going to get a call here, John, coming back to you, 410-319-8888. Lisa, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. Since we're talking about unacceptable behavior, I think it's very unacceptable that a Jewish man is on an African-American radio station.
Thanks, Lisa. People can have that opinion, but we're not going to deal with that now. You can always talk to the management. 410-319-8888. Alan, you're on the air.
Yeah, good morning. You know, years ago, I felt head over heels in love with a woman. I would send her gooey and gushy love letters, all kinds of gooey and gushy love letters. But they were, as James Bond would say, for your eyes only. And things did not work out well. And she, I don't know what she's got with them, but, you know, I did not intend for these letters to be spread out on the Internet. She lost the letters, thank God, for small favors. But what would have happened if somebody is enamored of somebody and they say, you are the sunshine of my love, blah, blah, blah. And then the other person breaks up and they keep the letters and then publish them.
John Carton. Thank you, Alan.
You're exactly right on that. And I forgot the name of the person.
Alan.
Let me remind you that the Supreme Court has held and has defined what things we should have a reasonable expectation of privacy of, whether they be images, whether they be phone conversations, whether they be lots of things that you can hold as private. And I'll give you an example that has nothing to do with pornographic images. But a phone conversation, let's just say that you're talking to your friend over the phone on a private line. You have a reasonable expectation of privacy that no one can use that information without your and your friend's permission. So if that's being tapped, there has to be a reasonable expectation by the government that criminality is afoot before they can listen in on that conversation. And this is the case here, going back to pornographic images. You have every right in the confines of your own home to do things with a reasonable expectation of privacy, and no one can take that away without your permit, or should be able to take that away without your permission. And that's all I'm saying here in this law.
And we also had a tweet that came in a bit earlier that said, it is not just teens that post this material. The behavior is committed by people of all ages. I'm glad you said that, because I didn't want to leave that impression. I was just raising the issue of young people. But Anne-Marie, this is, we're talking all ages are doing this, and this adults do this as well and as widely as young people.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. I was 39 when this happened to me, and my ex was 43.
So, I mean, I think that's really critical. That's why I was raising the issue of young people, because thinking of how we address young people who commit acts that they do, I think we should treat them differently than we do people who are adults and have complete responsibility for their actions. I think that this is a what kind of reception is this going to have in the Senate, do you think, John?
I mean, look, I don't want to get political, but I think the House passed unanimously, and I think that the Senate is very interested in seeing something done. So I am incredibly optimistic, and I know with the people like Anne-Marie and other advocates that we should be able to see it be successful. Certainly, it's interesting, politically speaking. I won't get into the details of who what committee hears this, but you can you can you can see whether politically we want to go there. I will say though that your intuition is right that young people. I think that the issue is that young people have a different expectation of privacy, and they're learning quickly how a lesser expectation can impact their lives in ways that they didn't expect in the out years. And that's what we're trying to get people to understand. And I think that hopefully this legislation will in fact be sort of an eye opener for many people who think that it's perfectly appropriate to be able to post images of other people without their consent, and realize that not only is it illegal, but it can have damaging impacts on people's lives.
And I'm very curious, Anne-Marie, before we break here, if you could just talk a bit about what you think we can do beyond the law. I mean, what is this we have to wrestle with in society? Because the technology, our behaviors, our human behaviors are what they are, the evil, wrong ones and the beautiful and pleasant ones. But the technology kind of warps it and changes it a lot. And so what do you think should be our response societally and as a culture and as people to this, to what we do beyond the law?
Beyond the law, I think the most important thing is education and advocacy. I am now that, the legislation is coming into place and that, this issue is in the news more. My next goal is to start educating young people about the Internet, not the dangers of the Internet, but just about valuing themselves. Kids who grew up with technology see it as a very, very abstract thing. The vastness and the density of the Internet is lost on people who have had it incorporated as part of their daily lives. To older people like us, we're looking from the outside, and we know what life was like before the Internet, and so we can see more clearly what the ramifications could be of certain behavior. So I think now there's when it comes to education, I know I'm going to tell my children, never share intimate images, protect who you are online and what you say and how much you reveal. So I think definitely education is one part of it. The second part is also changing attitudes. As much as I hate to say it, but it's very true, one of the sponsors of this bill in the news recently made a statement that blamed victims. And so we have people who are sponsoring this legislation who still think that the victims did something wrong, that we were the ones who were stupid. So we have to change those attitudes. We have to put the attention on the perpetrators of this behavior and say, is this really okay? Regardless of what anybody else did, is it really okay that we're saying, sure, go ahead. Put someone in the position where she's going to lose her job, her career. Had I lost my job, I would have lost my home, So I think that's what we're looking at right now is education and advocacy.
Anne Maria Chiarini, professor of English at Maryland Community College and victim advocate for the Cyber Civil Rights Initiative, and Delegate John Cardin, who introduced this bill, House Bill 43, who represents District 11, House of Delegates. Thank you both so much for joining us here on the Mark Steiner Show on WEAA 88.9 FM. Good to
Thank
have
you for having
with
us,
us.
Mark.
Thank you for having us, Mark.
Thank you. We can take a brief break, and when we come back, we're going to be joined by David Kirby to talk about these bills that are going on in California, but it may not affect the Maryland Aquarium directly because we don't have orcas, but raises the issue of what animals we should be allowed to keep and have as public pets, so to speak. Stay with us. We'll be right back.